This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Music Buzz Podcast. The Music Buzz Podcast features candid discussions with and about those behind the scenes in the music business, including industry veterans representing the segments of musician, design, and live. All three Music Buzz podcast hosts have spent their careers working with the biggest names in entertainment and have been and are still a fly on the wall. Dayton Clark as the drummer for John Mellencamp's band for over 20 years and various solo projects. Hugh Syme, a world-renowned graphic artist with the biggest names in music and the corporate world. Andy Wilson, an award-winning marketing and public relations executive with over 20 years of combined multi-level entertainment industry experience in the music and sports business. Now let's buzz.
Hello and welcome back to the Music Buzz Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Andy Wilson, along with Dane Clark. Hey, Dane.
Hi, Andy.
And also Hugh Syme. Hey, Hugh.
Hello, Andrew.
Our guest today on Music Buzz is the legendary bass guitarist Rick Wills, best known for his work with Foreigner and his association with a lot of other awesome bands, including the Small Faces, Roxy Music, Peter Frampton, Spooky Tooth, Bad Company, David Gilmour, and more. Welcome to the Music Buzz, Rick.
It's nice to be here with you, man. You know, I mean, we're just so thrilled at the moment and honored that we've been nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame at last. It's only taken 22 years. We kind of gave up on that one for a while back. But it's really nice. When we heard that we've been nominated, we were very happy boys. And I'm trying to do as much promotion as I can to get people to vote for us. And we're doing real well at the moment. We're in second place. Aussie's still beating us, but we're going to try and overtake him if we can.
Well, you know what? If you're going to be in second place, you might as well be behind Aussie, right? I mean, that's not so right. Bad. Might as well call it first place.
I'm really thrilled that Peter Frampton's in there too, you know, because he's been a lifelong friend of mine. And, you know, we did a lot of touring together in the early days when he left Humble Pie. And he asked me to help him out and if we, you know, come on the road in America, which is what I always wanted to do. Because, I mean, I'd done everything I could in England. You can do that in about a week, you know, poor country. But, we started touring here, and it was tough at first because you have to open up for everybody and start from the bottom and work your way up. And that's what we did for the next, three and a half, 4 years, basically.
A lot of those Frampton gigs, didn't you guys support Humble Pie, actually?
We did, yeah, at times. Yes, we did. Yeah, that was kind of neat, actually. That's how I got to know all the guys. I mean, Jerry Shirley and I had been in a band prior to that. We had a band in Cambridge called Little Women, and Jerry was the drummer. He was only 16 then when he got that gig. I mean, he was just a young guy, but boy, because he was a great drummer, that's for sure.
No question. We interviewed him. He's a real sweet guy.
He was my best man when my wife and I got married as well.
Really? Nice.
So he's been very special in our lives, Jerry.
Yeah, you know? He's good people for sure.
Yep.
Well, and I was just going to say, you know, I first started listening to you play on, I was a Humble Pie freak. And then so when Frampton split off, I had all those records. And that's when I first became, you know, aware of you and your your melodic grooving king of the eighth note feel bass parts,
Well,
which
tell me
are,
how you really feel. I mean, really, come
well, I mean, I'm a drummer, man, so
Keep going, keep going.
I listen to bass, and it's always been a pocket thing that you've done. And I'll get into some specific things later, some songs that I even want to talk about what you the specific things you played on. But first, take us back to you were a guitar player first and switched to bass. So tell us about that and those bands with David Gilmour, Jokers Wild and Bullet. Yeah.
Well, David and I both lived in Cambridge in the UK, in the same area of Cambridge, actually, a place called Nuneham. And he was in local bands, and I got into local bands. I started around 12 years old, 13. My mum, I bugged her to get me a guitar because I'd seen Lonnie Donegan on the TV and then The Shadows, which really hit me like a ton of bricks because The Shadows were so good. Cliff Richard's backing group. And they were awesome, man. I mean, they really were. The sound, everything about them was just wicked. I mean, it was so good. And they had, they had all Vox amps on Chrome stands. And that's the first time I ever saw Fenders for the first time. They had red pink Fenders. It was just, they were just awesome. I went to see them in the local theater in Cambridge, and I was just blown away. I thought, I gotta do that.
What year would that have been?
Oh, around about 1960, 60, yeah, 61, something like that. And that's what I wanted to do. And I was a pretty good rhythm guitarist, but I really liked the bass, and it just attracted me somehow, that Fender Precision Bass look. I thought, I want to do that. And that's what I did. I took it up, and to be honest, I kind of found it quite easy to do. And I just could pick songs up pretty easily. I've never learned to read music or anything like that. I just sat down and listened to 45 records, and learned songs.
All the good ones don't read music.
I know that for sure,
It's a thing,
But
yeah.
we didn't need to really, we just listened to one another play and got off on what was going on around us.
Actually listening to the other musicians, imagine that,
Oh
right?
yeah. Oh yeah. I sure did. I mean, I'm still listening to those guys. I've got a hell of a record collection. I really have. Probably about 500 albums and stuff like that. And I still love to play those old records because they sound so good. I mean, they stood the test of time.
So David Gilmour, how long were you guys, was that was like a year or two you guys were had that thing going?
Yeah, what happened was he was being like watched by a guy called Jonathan King, who was at university in Cambridge. And Jonathan King had a huge single in him called "Everyone's Gone to the Moon."
Yeah, I remember that on Ready Steady Go. I saw him on Ready Steady Go.
Yeah, he
Yeah.
was. He was. He used to keep an eye on Dave because he realized Dave was a very good-looking guy. In his teenage years, and he was also a very talented guitar player. And I was watching him too because I used to go to a lot of their gigs. He was getting a band called Jokers Wild. Jonathan decided that something had to happen for Dave because it was obvious he was going to places. So he said, "Look, Dave, I'd like to take you to London to meet a couple of guys that I know now." He said, "Well, who's that?" He said, "Well, it's Andrew Oldham, the Stones manager, and Brian Epstein, the Beatles manager." And Dave went, "Wow, you know those guys?" He said, "Oh, yeah, I know them." So he went to London and met these people, and they said, "Look, we think you've got a career ahead of you." I mean, they weren't far wrong there, that's for sure. And they said, "What we want you to do is go back to Cambridge, choose the guys you want to work with, and we're going to send you abroad. We want you to go and get it together, write some songs, do stuff like that." And he came back to Cambridge, and we met up in a pub in Cambridge called the Criterion. And he came to me that night, and he said, "Rick, how do you feel about moving to London?" I said, "Wow, I really would like to do that, Dave." And he said, "I've got a drummer called Willie Wilson, who I knew." He said, "Let's go get it together in London." And of course, at first, we didn't really have anywhere to stay. I was sleeping in Willie's car with Willie every night. We were just busking it, And Dave had friends up there, and he was hanging out with them. We were told that they wanted us to go to Spain. So with our equipment, we got on the train in London, off down to Dover, across the Channel into France, and that's a long journey, man, especially on a train with your equipment. I think we got as far as Calais with our gear, and that was the last we saw of him for about the next 2 weeks. We didn't know what happened. They said, "Well, we've got to check all this stuff, and you just go on the next train. You go up to Madrid, and then from Madrid down to Malaga, and then along to Marbella, where they wanted us to open up this new hotel. Well, the only thing they didn't tell us was the hotel wasn't built. So we got there, there was no hotel,
one hotel,
concrete
yeah.
base. You know? I said, well, that's not very good. Too cold to fly in there. So we ended up playing on the balcony of a golf club, for of all places, to people sitting below us, you know. And actually, we got pretty damn good, actually, at it. You know, we were just a three-piece at the time, but we knew a lot of songs between us, you know. And I'd been in a soul band kind of prior to that all happening. And we had two American black singers, and they taught us a lot of the black music from the States that we didn't know, Temptations, Smokey Robinson, all that kind of stuff. And we got pretty good at doing all those covers, you know. And eventually we did about 3 months in Spain. And then someone said, why don't you come to Paris in France? Because we can work you out of there for the whole of France. France is a big country. And we said, well, that sounds like a good thing to do because we all like France. Dave could speak perfect French, by the way. He had very good linguistic skills. So we based ourselves in Paris and we weren't earning much money. I mean, probably, you know, $15, $20 a night for gigging, you know, each, which wasn't much, you know, to feed yourself on and live. But we made it for at least a year and a half, I would say, into 68, where we finally said, we've had it. We've had enough of this. We're starving. Dave was getting sick. We went back to England in our van. Our friend of ours called Nick Jarvis came and got us in a van. And when we got back to England, Dave was contacted by Floyd, Pink Floyd, who we knew. We knew the guys in the Floyd. And they said, look, we're having real problems with Sid Barrett, the singer and guitar player. Sid had done a lot of LSD, man, and he was really messed up, really messed. He couldn't even think straight. I mean, he was just, it was terrible because he was a really nice guy, a good-looking guy, and then he just blew his mind, basically. And they said, Dave, can you come and help us out? And that's how it started for Dave to join Pink Floyd. And they used to pick up Sid and Dave and go on shows together, and then gradually they just didn't bother to pick Sid up. They just took David. And he became the guitarist for Pink Floyd. And the rest, as we all know, is history, because it was about the best thing they could have ever done to have a front man like Dave with the voice he's got and his guitar skills. Because Dave was very serious about guitar playing. I mean, he never put the guitar down. Even if he was at home in his house, he'd still be sitting in front of the TV fiddling with his guitar all the time. And I just think he became such a great player. I mean, some of the solo.
Oh, my gosh. One of the greatest.
Just listen to Comfortably Numb, the solo on that record. It's just amazing.
No question.
Amazing song, too.
Yeah. You're not going to get any arguments from us about his skills, man. He's a genius.
So happy that it worked for him because, it's been his career. He's now kind of retired from the whole thing now. He does the odd charity thing for people.
I saw him playing his solo show at Massey Hall in Toronto, and I'm so accustomed to seeing him with the big Pink Floyd machine with 17 people on stage, but seeing him on stage with five people hold the room together, he's such a masterful player. His sing, it blew my mind how he affected that whole room, you know, and he did five nights in a 2,200-seat hall, which was...
I'm not surprised. I mean, he's kind of... On stage, David's kind of understated. He doesn't make a big deal out of it. You know, he just looks at his guitar and he plays and sings. You know, that's the way he is. And the bass player he used, Guy Pratt, is an excellent player, by the way. Really good guy. And, you know, they all were. But Dave just had that knack of holding an audience. You know, he was very good at it. So I'm delighted. I've been friends with him all my life. And he's just still grooving along happily.
You ended up reconnecting with him and playing on his 1978, that first solo record, right?
He just decided he wanted to make a solo album. It was the thing to do in those days. You know, everybody seemed to be making solo albums outside of the band they were in.
What was the name of that record? Was that About Face?
No, it's just called David Gilmour.
It's David Gilmour, okay.
Self-titled record, yeah.
I've got the gold album in my toilet down here right now. Because it finally went gold. I mean, it didn't sell greatly at first, but it gradually grew on people because it's a good album. Some good songs on there.
Who played drums on that record?
Willie Wilson.
Okay.
Yeah, same guy that we went off to London.
Same guy that you guys were in the band with. Yeah. That's awesome. Cool.
Yeah, he ended up in a band called... Quiver,
I remember that band.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we just got it done. We did. We went to France to record it down in the south of France, which they really, I mean, we like France, period, because of the food and the lifestyle of French. And we made the album there, and then we took it back to London. The Floyd by then had got their own studio called Britannia Row. So we did all the overdubs and mixing and vocals, backing vocals there. And then Dave, you know, what, you know, he was producing and engineering really pretty much. I mean, he's got an engineer, but he's very capable to do the whole thing. He loves the studio. He really does. You know, that's his world. The fiddling with knobs and faders, you know, that's what he likes. You know, it just panned out great. And we really liked that album. I thought it was good. There's some good songs on there.
It is sure. A good record. I have that on vinyl. I think it's a great record.
I have to go back and listen to that one. I remember it at the time, but it's been a long time, yeah.
It's actually a cool album cover, too. Very simple, but very...
That's in his backyard, in his house in the country. See, we knew Hypnosis, the album cover guys, you know, Poe and Storm. We knew them very well. We were all friendly from Cambridge. Of course, they did all their Floyd's album covers, not to mention everybody else, Zeppelin, Bad Company, whoever, you know.
Storm was a character.
Oh, Storm was a big character. He was great fun. See, he's not with us anymore, I'm afraid.
I know.
But Poe is, and Poe's still doing great.
And George Hardy?
I don't know George, but I knew Poe and Storm very well. And, you know, Poe's still, you know, he's still grooving around doing stuff. In fact, he just contacted me just the other day because he's Mark Ronson, who is Mick's stepson, married to Anne. He's been helping us with videos and stuff. I don't know if you've seen any of this stuff where we've got like Dave Grohl, Slash, and people saying you've got to support Foreigner, get them in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Well, he managed to get Paul McCartney to do it, which I was amazed. I mean, we've met Paul a good few times, and Mick knew him pretty well. He was in his car and he's saying, Foreigner, not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? What the fuck? And he says the word, I mean, he never swears on TV.
Right. Really? Yeah. You got Paul to do the F word, man. That's awesome.
You know? That's two accomplishments. You got him to do it and cuss.
Yeah. Okay.
To see Paul McCartney do that, I said, no, that's it. I mean, really.
That's really all you need. You don't need everybody
that's
else.
That's all
as
you
long
need.
As you have
no.
That.
Have that.
I
that's
mean,
all you
so
need.
So many billions of followers anyway. So if that goes out to them and they all vote for us, we're in good shape, you know.
So you went from the Gilmore solo thing, kind of reuniting there, and then that slid into your being in Foreigner, correct, at that time or soon after?
No, it didn't.
Oh, it didn't. Okay. I thought the years kind of lined up.
After
there.
That thing we did, I was involved in different projects in London and around. And then I got, you know, when Peter came along and had left Humble Pie, he wanted to do a solo album called Wind of Change. And he asked me if I would do some of the bass playing. He had Andy Bam, Ringo Starr, all these different people to play on the album. So I said, oh, Pete, I said, I'd be delighted to do that because we were using Olympic Studios in London, which was by far the best studio in Barnes. And I just did some of the sessions. You know, we did.
Which songs did you play on? Because
quite a lot.
That's one of my favorite records he ever did was Winds of Change. Did you play Fig Tree Bay?
I think I did, yes. Yes, I did.
What a cool song, man.
I mean, that's where we first wrote Do You Feel Like We Do?
Which came out on the next record. Came out on Frampton's Camel. But
that's right. That's right. Oh, that's right. It's on that album, yeah. Well, that was the first song Peter and I actually wrote together. When we were sort of getting it together as a band, he said, let's form a band. I'm going to get Mike Kelly for Spooky Tooth, Mickey Gallagher, who we knew from Newcastle as a keyboard player, myself and Peter. And we called it Frampton's Camel. And then there was another band in London called Peter Barnes's Camel. And he said, you can't use that name. So we said, well, what are we going to do? He said, let's call it Peter Frampton. That's it, Peter Frampton Band, which made sense because Peter was very well known, obviously, everywhere. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we had to work from the bottom. And boy, we really did work. I must have played every school and college and crappy hall in the whole of the United States. But we did it, and we got real good, you know, at what we were doing.
I saw you guys live
did
in
you really?
That period. It was during a, well, and there's a forgotten record that a lot of people forget about, which was the Something's Happening record, which I hadn't listened to for, I don't know, for 40 years until I'd listened last night again. And I'm telling you what, man, that your band at that time, you guys, Doobie Wah, Golden Goose, I had forgotten about that. Underhand, man, I'll tell you what, that's some of the coolest groove drum and bass stuff that you can hear from that time period. It's, you guys were a smoking band.
I also co-wrote Doobie Wah with Peter as well. I've got my name on that one as well.
That doesn't hurt to have that, does it?
Yeah.
It sure did, because it was on the live album. Perhaps It Comes
yes,
to Life.
Yes, it was.
Biggest live album ever.
Yeah.
Got about 18 million copies or something in the States alone. After I'd been with the Small Faces, I realized that Peter's success had just been gigantic. You know, he was huge. Frampton Comes Alive had just taken over. So I called Peter's manager, D. Anthony, in New York. He had an office on Park Avenue. He had managed Humble Pie and various, a lot of artists, actually, Joe Cocker, people like that. And I called D up and I said, D, I said, I'm kind of thinking I might be owed some money. He said, oh, Rick, you're owed a lot of money. He said, we're trying to work it out. I said, it's just been so big, this record. He said, why don't you come over to New York and come and see me in the office? So I had, you know, Small Faces had kind of fallen apart. Steve was a little bit out there with the drinking and, you know, substances. I went to stay with Jerry Shirley. He had an apartment in Manhattan. And then I went to see Dee at the office, and we talked about it all. And he says, it's just gone crazy, this whole thing. And he gave me a check that day for $35,000. Now, I've never seen that much money in my life at that point. This was, you know, early 79. So I said, went back to Jerry. I said, you know, if I guess what? I said, I've got $35,000. And I went down to the bank teller to try and cash it because he made it out to cash. And she said, are you sure, Mr. Wills, you want to take $35,000 out of here? He said, you're in New York. You know, you could get robbed, mugged, anything. I said, well, what would you suggest I do? She said, put it in a safety deposit box. I'll give you a key. You can come in the bank whenever you want, take out some cash, whatever you need, and that way it's safe. So Jerry and I proceeded to party for the next 2 or 3 days. Put these
in the bank. And no, you guys spent $35,000?
Surely not.
And we had the best time. And in that 2 or 3 days, on
that a hell of a party.
Damn, oh, I wish I'd have been in on that.
In that 2 or 3 days, we heard on the wire.
That's almost $12,000 a day you guys partied then, huh?
I know. We didn't spend it all, don't worry. We heard on the wire that Foreigner was going to change out their bass player. Ed Gagliardi was going to be let go, and they were auditioning for a bass player. And I called Mick up. Jerry had a number for Mick Jones. I know Mick since 67 in Paris. I said, Mick, I'm in New York. He said, oh, I didn't know you were here. I said, yeah, I'm here. I said, can I audition for the band? I said, I love what you're doing. I love the first two albums you made, Foreigner and Double Vision. He said, well, he said, how well do you know the songs? I said, I know them off by heart. I said, I've had them in my car on 8-track in those days, and I had on BMW at the time. I used to just play it constantly, you know, all the time. So I really knew the songs, and I just thought it was great. Great, great songs, great writing, everything. He said, well, why don't you come to SIR Studios in New York and we'll run through a couple of things, see how it works out. I did. He lent me a bass, actually, to use, a Fender bass. I plugged in and I said, he said, what do you want to do? I said, well, Double Vision, Hot-Blooded, Feels Like the First Time, Cold as Ice. And we ran through those songs and it was just like clockwork. It was just sounded so good because they wanted a richer, deeper bass end. Because Ed used to use a Rickenbacker, and it was kind of very trebly sound.
Yeah. Yes, that's the problem with us, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, Dennis Elliott, the drummer, who's powerhouse drummer, he really is.
Good player.
He got off his kit, just walked to the front of the stage where I'd been standing, playing. He said, I want him in the band, pointing to me. Mick just went, no, Dennis, you can't do that. So we got 70 bass players to audition. And I had the biggest grin on my face you could ever imagine. I mean, I was so like, wow, this could not be true, you know, what was happening. So I said, well, what do I do? He said, just hang in here. So we've got so many guys to see and go over. So we must do this. I said, okay. I said, I'll come back in like a couple of weeks and we'll run over the arrangements and do some vocals and, you know, just tighten it up. He said, yeah, okay, that's fine. And that went really well too, because, you know, we really just gelled. I mean, as a rhythm section, Dennis and I just, we just seemed to be natural.
That makes all the difference right there.
Oh, yeah, it really did, you know. And it was, they were just such nice guys. They were kind of laid back and pretty tired from touring on that Double Vision album. They'd done a lot of shows. I said, well, look, you know, what do I do? He said, just hang in there. We're getting closer. We're just, you know, bringing the list down to a small group of guys, and you're one of them. And then I called my wife in London. we had two young children at the time. I think my daughter was about five, Nikki, and my son Daniel was about 18 months. And I called her up. She said, "Rick, would you come back to London, please? I'm going nuts. The kids have got chicken pox, and I can't deal with it." I said, "But Lynn, I can't leave here." I said, "I might get the job, you know." I didn't know what to do, but I did go home. I got a flight. Oh, I was actually, I must admit, I was going to try and go on Concorde because I could afford to. I did. I was sensible. I went home in the back of the plane like normal in economy. So I got back to London, and I'm home for one day and one night. And the phone rings at 8 a.m. and it's Bud Prager, Foreigner's manager, and Mick Jones in the office asking me how I was feeling. And I said, "Well, I'm kind of groggy and jet-lagged at the moment, to be honest." He said, "Well, you're going to feel great, Rick." I said, "Why?" He said, "You've just got the job before. We want you to come straight back to New York." I said, "Today?" He said, "Yes, today."
Oh, shit.
I mean, it was
okay.
He said, "Go to British Airways desk in Heathrow, and there's a ticket waiting for you to come back to New York." I went. My wife dropped me off. I said, I'll keep in touch. You know, I'll let you know how everything goes. And the lady behind the desk, she said, "Oh, Mr. Wills, we're so sorry, but the Concorde is actually sold out today. It's full." I said, "Concorde? I don't do Concorde." She said, "No, you had a ticket for Concorde." I said, "But it's full." So I said, "Well, what do I do?" He said, "Would you mind sitting in first class in a 747? I just laughed. I just had
Gee,
to laugh.
Okay.
Come on, you know, you got to be kidding me. And so there I was in first class. And in those days, this was early, well, March 79, upstairs was a lounge on the 747, right? Where you could go and hang out and sit. And there was a bar. So I thought, well, I've got 7 or 8 hours of flying to New York. I can have a drink or two. I shall know what we're working today. There's no way I can enjoy myself. Telling all the crew what has happened to me. You know, I got the job with Foreign, and this is incredible, blah, 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 all this stuff. So I get to New York, get my bags, and I go out. And one of the road crew, a guy called Troby Laidlaw, was there with his car. He said, "Rick, I've got to take you straight to rehearsals. We're rehearsing today." I went,
Oh, man, you've
got to be kidding.
That's a beating.
Too much drink. I should go to a coffee shop. Go to a coffee shop right now and get me two big black coffees. I said, "I've got to straighten up." I said, you know, I felt like I could still play, but I had quite a bit of a drink. That's what we did. I went to SIR again, and we started running through some new songs that they'd written for Head Games. I remember playing through Dirty White Boy, Head Games, a couple of other songs. They said, "Right, we're going in the studio in the next day or two to Atlantic Studios on Broadway," which was a very famous studio. I mean, you know, anybody on Atlantic used to record there, from Aretha Franklin, you name them. And it was a lovely, funky old studio. When I put my bass rig in, I had to put it in like a cupboard so that it didn't spill over the drums that were in the room, you know. So just the four of us, Mick Jones, Lou Graham, me and Dennis, set about putting down the basic tracks. And we cut Dirty White Boy, Head Games, and a few others. And I went into the control room to listen. And Roy Thomas Baker was our producer on that album. He's a great guy, very funny, real character. And he got what I wanted. I said, "I really want to hear the bass drums beef it up, you know?" And they did. I mean, if you listen to Head Games, I mean, what I played on that is just an open A and a on the fifth fret of the E string A, and then a do at the top. It just really worked. Dirty White Boy just went off like, boom.
Dirty White Boy is you do those octave jump things in that. It's just badass, man. Great track.
Thank you.
Good stuff.
And we just felt so natural for us. We just gelled as a band straight away. You know, Ian and I were in different rooms doing keyboards and overdubs and all that sort of stuff. But we knocked that album off pretty quickly, actually. We recorded for about, I don't know, probably a couple of months in New York. Then we took it to LA to finish it, do mixing. I came back to New York thinking, I'll be rehearsing with the band before we do our first show up in New York State in Binghamton. Well, that never happened because Mick and Ian were still there mixing. And the next thing I know, we're doing a show. And I hadn't rehearsed with the band at all, not for a show live, you know. So there I am standing on stage the first night. We're going through the set, and it's just a big crowd, you know, 10, 12,000 people. And I'm thinking, what the hell's going on with this? This is nuts, but it was really good. And we soon got it together. You know, it didn't take long. Within a week, we were really rocking. And that's how it all began. really did. And it was just nonstop from there for the next, well, I don't know how many years, a lot.
Did you sing with the band?
Oh, yeah. I've always done backing vocals. Yeah, always. Lou and I did quite a lot of the backing vocals on the album, actually, together. When Mick, you know, if he had a really late night, he had a habit of staying late to fiddle with things. So Lou and I would usually be there first. So we said, well, we won't waste time. We'll do some BVs, you know. That's what we used to do. We did quite a lot of that stuff. I still do to this day. I still sing with the band when I play with them. And we're going to plan quite a few more shows. I know Al Greenwood and I will definitely be doing more shows this year with the band. I mean, we do the end of the show. We probably do two or three songs, probably Long Runway From Home, Want to Know What Love Is, and Hot Blooded, probably.
With Lou?
I don't know if Lou is going to make it. I just don't know. He's had health issues, as you probably all know. He had a brain tumor a good few years back. And it really changed him as a person. And he had so many steroids pumped into him.
That was way back, right? That was.
Oh, yeah.
Because I played Midnight Blue with him live on the radio, and must have been 1990 or 91 or something. That had already happened.
Well, he was pretty sick. And when we did the Then and Now shows back in 2017-18, he was good, but he wasn't the same. His range had changed. His actual vocal range had changed. So with Kelly Hansen being in the band we have now, that Mick put them there, and we all agreed that they were all the right people because they're a terrific bunch of guys and very good. So it was a pleasure playing with them because they play Foreigner like Foreigner used to play Foreigner.
Yeah, they are good.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people say, oh, it's a cover band. It's not true. That's not true. They are Foreigner that we put there to do and carry on what we don't want to do, all the traveling and touring now that we're all in our mid-70s, for goodness sake. You know, we're not kids anymore. Right. Now, there's fun when you're 30 doing all that, but it ain't when you're mid-70s, believe you me.
Mid-60s is tough.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Well, there you go. You know.
Well, those succession of albums that Foreigner, you mentioned Head Games being the first one you were on, but talk a little bit about making four with Mutt Lange and that whole experience, because that record is obviously, there's a lot of big Foreigner records, but that's got to be like the pillar, right?
And my buddy Mark Rivera plays sax on that record too. Oh,
Mark's such a diamond. He's a lovely,
ain't he a great guy? Wonderful.
He's
guy.
He's the greatest guy. I'm so pleased Billy's given him the role he's got as like musical director. And I'll keep in touch with Mark. I'm so sorry that Bob Mayo's still not with us. You know, he's gone. But he was a fantastic keyboard player. He had perfect pitch. If he heard something, he could play it. It was just one of those gifts he was given. But Mark is just a lovely, lovely guy. I love him to death. His energy, his everything about him is great. So what happened was, you know, we did the Head Games album. It came out, and it was doing good. It was doing okay, but not great. Not like Double Vision had done. And a lot of people said, it's because of the album cover. So the girl in the urinal.
Oh, the toilet. Yeah.
And he said it's offensive. And the rackers, people who put the albums, you know, in stores, they said they don't like that. They weren't going to touch that. And I thought, well, that's ridiculous. I mean, it's called Head Games. That's what it's all about. A girl trying to rub her name out on the wall of the urinal. Anyway, it didn't do as well as we hoped it would. It probably did 3-4 million, maybe 5 in the end, which was good. I mean, in those days, sales were big. So we decided when we came off the road after that year of doing Japan everywhere that we had to do something really, really special for the next album. And Mick had wanted to work with Mutt Lange for a long time because his work was without doubt excellent in every way. And Mutt's one of the hardest working people you'll ever meet. South African and a lovely guy, but determined to get his own way in many ways, many things, and Mick's the same.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
The Clash heads, man, I'm telling you.
Was there any headbutting going on there?
Oh, yeah, there was a lot of horns there, I'm telling you. So we set about doing that album, and Mutt said, look, we've got to come up with some fantastic songs for this album to get you back to where you should be, 10, 12 million sort of sales. And we started out, funnily enough, the first track we cut was Waiting for a Girl Like You, which, you know, I thought was a natural. I said to Mick, that's number one. Well, a young lady called Olivia Newton-John held us off that spot. We got to number two for 12 weeks. It's still a great, you know, great result. We just had to keep writing, rewriting ideas until Mutt was happy with what we had. And he wanted an anthem, Jukebox Hero. That's what it became. And it is. I mean, it is today one of the biggest songs you'll hear Foreigner play live any night. We came up with the idea, Mick had this riff for Urgent. You know, we didn't have a lyric at the time, and he went off to the bathroom of all places and came back and said, I've got a lyric. I said, what's
he urgently ran off to the bathroom, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I gotta go.
I do that every day.
Yeah.
Dang,
yeah,
man.
We all know what that feels like. Urgent.
It's the story of my life.
Okay. Yeah. I know, man. But you know,
Dane ends every podcast with that same sense of urgency.
Yeah, I gotta go, boys.
He really does, actually. It's not even a joke.
But and then Mick went out one night to check out Junior Walker and the All-Stars in a club in New York. And he invited them back after they finished playing to come to the studio where we were. And he said, Junior, we'd love you to play a solo on this track called Urgent. And at first, we couldn't get him to play like, you know, the old style Junior Walker with that boop, boop, boop sound. And we finally got him into it. And we did quite a bit of editing on that. We had to get it the way we wanted it. But it really worked. And Mark Rivera does the lead into it, and then Junior does the solo. Yeah, that's Junior Walker. And again, that was kind of unique. You know, radio stations like that connection between Junior and Foreigner. And it was something different for us, too. Urgent was not exactly your normal Foreigner song, but it really, really worked.
Oh, it's
and
great.
It was very popular.
My favorite one you guys ever did.
Mine too. Well,
and my favorite the album track. Just contained a lot of good stuff. It really, really did. And it just paid off. Because I used to listen to a station in New York called WNEW, a guy called Scott Mooney, very, very well-known DJ. And he played Urge one day for the first time. And I was actually outside working on the roof of my house. And I had the radio on out there with me. And it just sounded really good through the radio. Because you know how they compress things on radio and stuff like that. It sounded really punchy and good. I thought, wow, that sounds great. And the next thing I knew, it was up in the charts. You know, we're doing really, really well. I mean, Waiting for a Girl Like You followed it. And we knew that was going to obviously go places. And it went straight up to the top of the charts. It stayed there for ages. And then they were a bit slow in releasing Jukebox Hero for some reason. I don't know why. But again, you know, that went straight into the charts and people loved it. It became a big song for us. So we had a great year. The 80s were just magic.
Did you have a hand in I Want to Know What Love Is?
Oh, yeah.
I think it's one of the best rock ballads ever. I mean,
I think you're right.
It is. Between Lou's vocal, my God, just a beautiful song. Yeah.
It is. It's classic. I mean, Mick had the idea. He had the chord pattern before he had the lyric. But it's all him. So it's really Mick Jones's song. So I know Lou's sometimes a bit bitter about not getting the credit on there. But it's Mick's song. I mean, he had the idea. When he actually put the lyric to it, I said, that's definitely number one, Mick. It's got to be number one. And it was. You know, it took the album to number one. It took the single number one. And we had the best year. We had like Billy Squire opening for us, Brian Adams, Joe Walsh, all those kind of people that made it a really big show for the people to come and see. And I think nearly every show was sold out. So we had a wonderful year of tremendous excitement. We really did.
I got a question on that song too. How did Tom Bailey from the Thompson Twins end up being involved?
That's because they let Al Greenwood and Ian McDonald out of the band. Okay. Because Mick felt that if we kept the core of the four of us, Dennis, Lou, Mick, and myself, mm-hmm. we could then bring in who we liked to make different textures in the songs we were making. And it was a really good idea, actually, because it worked. We had Tom Dolby come over from the UK to work with us, and he added a lot of different ideas that we didn't really know about because his keyboard playing was unusual, you know, and a very experimental. So that gave us the freedom. Also, with Mark Rivera helping out in the studio too, and Bob Mayo to some degree, we had the freedom of all those different characters and ideas to work with as well. So I think that's another reason why the album became so diverse, but really, really strong.
Mm-hmm.
We were very happy with the result.
It's a classic, man. Yeah, there's no denying that.
Okay. Good. I'm glad you think so.
No denying that.
Speaking of girls sitting on urinals, how involved were you as a band or as individuals within the band in determining your album artwork, or was that all label driven?
A lot of it came from the record company. Mm-hmm. You know, they have their album cover design people. I think that really came more from them than us. The head
guys. I see. Yeah.
Whereas Four was actually my idea. I just said, look, there's four of us now in the band.
Great
just
cover.
Four. We thought about it. We thought when we do live shows, we can do a countdown on a screen behind us. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, we appear on the stage. And it stays there on four. And it really worked. It was very dynamic, you know.
Well, it speaks to the chronology of the album and the members in the band. But it's a great piece of graphic work. Did you ever call on Storm or the boys in Hypnosis?
Yeah, I did. I wanted them to be involved because they said, why don't we do, you know, an album cover for you guys? And I can't remember. I think it was either Agent Provocateur or Inside Information, one of those albums. I think they were involved in it.
Provocateur is a beautiful graphic as well. It's phenomenal. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Storm was quite a character. He didn't hold back what he thought and said, you know.
Not only that, he went about his creations quite lavishly. I mean, the very fact that he took that many beds to the beach for momentary lapse of, you know, I mean, come on.
I know. You see, when I took him to meet Bud Prager, Bud didn't like him very much. He said, this guy's
broken.
No, because, I mean, that's just Storm. He doesn't hold back, you know. He tells it as it is. They're too expensive and they've got too much to say for themselves. I said, well, that's what they do, you know.
Well, controlling art directors, man, they're just all.
Well, they did a lot of great work. I mean, the Floyd albums, you know, there's some really deep thinking going into that. You know, Wish You Were Here and things like that. You know, come on, you know, Dark Side of the Moon. You know, I mean, what? I mean, it's just a simple idea, really, but it worked so well.
I've often used Wish You Were Here as an example of how to talk a band off the ledge when they have too many opinions of their own.
Yeah.
I said, as an art director, if I told you I wanted to have two guys in business suits standing on a Burbank back lot with a lot of white buildings, shaking hands. Oh, and by the way, one of them happens to be on fire.
Yeah, on fire. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
You'd probably show me the door just from, you know.
It is perfect for that record, though, and that band.
It's a phenomenal obviously. Cover. Yeah. That's my point.
Well, it's a great song. David sings it so well as well. I mean, it's the whole idea of the. I mean, Roger wrote most of the lyrics. You know, I mean, Roger was a very difficult character. He had his own way, and that's how he was. And he could be very, very critical sometimes, shall we say, you know. And he still is to this day, and he's still very outspoken about Russia and all kinds of things, you know. But that's Roger, you know. What are you going to do? You know, at least when he got out, was put out of the band, basically. David got Nick Mason and Rick Wright still to stay with him and called it Pink Floyd, quite rightly so, 3-1. Roger, to this day, says it's not right, but, you know, it must have been hard for him when he put his own band together to go out and do the wall. And, you know, Pink Floyd would be playing in the big arena and he'd be playing in a smaller venue. And I'm sure that there was a few moments with David, Nick and Rick quite enjoyed that, actually.
Probably so.
You know what he's like in the band.
Well, yeah. Roger Waters is, you know, no offense to him, but I'm sorry, but David Gilmour is the voice.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned.
Without a doubt. Roger's certainly.
Otherwise, you got voice. Some, it's karaoke. If you go see Roger Waters, somebody else is singing up there. Who's that guy? He wasn't in a band. Come on now.
I know, man.
Don't hold back, Dane.
That's just how I feel. Me and Storm.
That's all right, bro. Say what we think.
So, from Foreigner to Bad Company, how did the Bad Company connection come up for you?
It got to 92, and Lou had been persuaded to be making a solo album outside of Foreigner by those that know better in record company, right?
Was that the Keith Olsen
Midnight Blue record?
Midnight Blue, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah.
Lou just took that on board because everybody was saying, oh, he's the voice of Foreigner. He's the one. He's the voice. Well, to a degree, yes, that is true. But Mick was also the powerhouse writer of the ideas of the songs, you know.
Yeah,
right.
They worked very well together. But anyway, Lou decided that's what he wanted to do. So in doing that, he kind of left the band. And we were stuck because, boy, it's hard to replace Lou Gramm as a voice, believe me. And we tried a lot of people. John Waite being one of them. And he was very close to being in the band at one point.
Oh, really?
But Mick decided it wasn't quite right.
I worked with John on Bad English.
Yeah. I mean, I like John a lot. He's all right. What happened was I said to my wife, I said, I think I'm going to have to leave the band because Mick was a little bit out there at the time. And Bud Bragg used to keep saying, because I'd gone back to England to live at that point. He said, can you come back to New York and look after Mick? Because he's really not behaving too well. And I tried, but I just couldn't keep up with him. He was just running pretty wild in New York at the time. These days, he's totally straight, doesn't drink or anything, thank God. But then it was difficult, and I decided, I just can't do this, you know. And I called up Simon Kirk and Mick Rouse, and I said, guys, are you touring this year? They said, yeah, we're going out in September. I said, do you need a bass player? I said, we do, actually. I said, we've just decided we want to get somebody different in. I said, well, I'd love to do it. I said, okay, let's work it out. I know Bad Company songs because they're not that difficult to play, to be honest. And, you know, it just felt right. We had Mick Rouse, an extra guitarist called Dave Bucket Colwell, Simon Kirk, myself, and at the time, Brian Howe was the singer. And they had quite a bit of success with the albums that Brian had written, Holy Water, stuff like that. So off we went in September, touring. And after a while, I said, you know, Brian Howard had a crazy way about him. He thought he was funny, but it really wasn't that funny. And I said, I know a guy in England called Robert Hart who's got a voice just like Paul Rogers. I said, he's a good-looking guy too. I said, he would make a much better frontman, I think, for Bad Company than Brian, which I know it sounds awful and he's not around anymore to defend himself, but I kind of was the instigator of that move. And we got Robert into the band. And it really worked because he did sound like Paul Rogers. But, he was a good-looking boy, blonde hair, great-looking guy. Girls liked him. So I was there for 10 years, from 92 right through to 2002 with Bad Company. We did a lot of touring with a lot of bands, you know, either in the middle slot or headlining, one of them being Lynyrd Skynyrd, who we got to know really, really well.
Yeah, you guys did do a lot of dates with them, yeah. And Damn Yankees too, right?
Yeah. Damn Yankees, yeah. All those guys.
Yeah.
We did a lot of work, a lot of touring. And not realizing one day I got a call from Lynyrd Skynyrd's management saying, Leon, the bass player, keeps falling off stage, Rick. He's just out there with the fairies at the moment. He said, you know, we've got to put him into rehab and we want someone to help us out. We don't want to stop touring. Can you come over and play bass for us? I thought about it, you know, I thought, well, I don't know how this is going to work. Because, you know, they're Southern boys. They're a pretty crazy bunch.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm English, as you can tell. I went and did it. And I did enjoy it because the songs are good. There's a lot of good songs. But I've got to admit, it was kind of hard at times to fit in as my way and their way. And it didn't always work out so well. I used to get back in my room and go, I don't know if I could do this much longer. I'm going crazy. After about 8 weeks, they decided that Leon had been in rehab long enough and they should get him back into the band. And I said, listen, guys, thank you for having me and having a great time, but I'm going home. And I did. I went back to London.
You did your job.
I did my job.
You know, you're joining Lynyrd Skynyrd. Now, I know you've heard some of those songs, of course, but how long did it take you to prepare to get out and do a totally different gig? Probably had to learn 2 hours worth of stuff, I would assume.
Oh, yeah, it was. I mean, you know, some of their stuff is pretty complex. I mean, like when they do Freebird, that's just a builder from nothing.
That's all figured out.
Yeah. Ending, and they're all soloing and they're all playing. And I just like to stand back by the drummer, you know, and play the rhythm section. Let those guys get on with it out front, you know, Gary and everybody. But it was a good experience, but not an easy one. I've got to say, it really wasn't. It was, there were moments where I thought I really shouldn't be doing this. It's not my cup of tea, really. And after that, you know, I just sort of, I met up with an old friend, Kenny Jones from the Small Faces, who had a polo club in Surrey.
As one does.
As one does, yes, of course. And Robert Hart met Kenny and they were getting on. They said, well, let's form a band. He said, well, who should we put on bass? He said, let's call Rick. So they called me up. I said, come over to the Polo Club, you know, and hang out with us and see what we can do. He said, we're thinking of asking Dave Bucket Caldwell, who you've been playing with in Bad Company as well, to do something with us. And he said, I said, well, what are you going to call yourself? And they said, we don't know. I said, call yourself the Jones Gang, like the James Gang, where, you know, Joe Walsh's old band. And they went, oh, that's a good idea, the Jones Gang. I like that, you know, because it doesn't really say much, but it says what it is. It's a gang of guys who have fun. And we made an album and we did quite a lot of shows. And it was really nice. I really enjoyed it for a few years. But it really wasn't going anywhere big, you know. And then the whole idea of this Foreigner thing, getting back to a reunion situation, that was what I was interested in. Because I wanted to see if we could still do it. And lo and behold, we could. We did it. I mean, it wasn't quite the same. I mean, we had Kelly and the boys that are in the band now with us, and we were on stage with them, and they made it possible because Bruce Watson, the guitarist, is the closest thing to Mick Jones I've ever known. He's the only person I know who can play like Mick, because Mick is one off. And the keyboard player, Michael Bluestein, again, you know, excellent, you know, really good player. Chris Fraser, the drummer, great player. Jeff Pilson, the bass player. I mean, he tells me, he said, I try and copy every note you played on every record so I can get it right. He said, do you think I've got it right? I said, I'll let you know.
Well, you're pretty close, pal.
Yeah. I like teasing him, you know. And then we got a new guy, Louis Carlos, came in after Tom Gimbel went. And he's, oh, man, he's such a great player. And he's such a lovely guy, too. Killer player. So for me now to go out and be on the road with them from time to time is a pleasure because they're really, really good. They are. They do a great show.
If I could interject on Foreigner, and I've done a lot of work over the years on Foreigner shows and worked with Mary Hart and Phil and everybody. And, you know, there's a lot of great bands out there, but the ones that really stand the test of time a lot of times are the ones that not only put in the work on the early years, you know, like you guys did, but they just continue to work hard. Even when they are selling tickets, they still do interviews. They still do the meet and greets. They still do things for the fans. Every Foreigner show now you go to, I mean, they're coming out raising money and giving it back to, you know, every city they're in. They do the whole raffle stuff, and you know, it's like, it's refreshing to see that kind of, you know, they don't have to do that stuff.
I mean, the other thing we do also that Kelly's promoting now also is bringing school kids in to be the choir in one
of
the
Yeah,
that's right. You
know,
yeah,
nice. Because we want to make them aware that music is important and that we've got to promote that in schools for kids to get involved, because that's the only way we're going to get new talent and stuff. You know, that's what we want to do. Yeah, we do a lot of good stuff for charity and St. Jude and people like that. You know, it's really worthwhile doing it. I know this is called the Farewell Tour at the moment. That's what we've, you know, obviously been promoting, because Kelly got married a couple of years ago to a lovely lady who he met in England. She's Polish, actually.
You're allowed 5 farewell tours.
I know. Well, we're working on the first one now. The second one's next year.
There you go.
Because of this Rock and Roll Hall of Fame thing happening, Phil convinced Kelly that he'll do 40 shows next year. Put it that way. That's what we're talking about. We haven't said what they are yet, but he's asked me and Al if we'll do 10, 12 shows this fall, because you know they do the Venetian in Las Vegas. They do one in the spring. Now they're doing one in the fall as well. Usually about 8 or 10 shows in a row. And that's nice because the Venetian's a lovely hotel and it's a nice venue to be at. I probably won't do the whole 10 days, but I'll do 2 or 3 maybe, you know. And, you know, because Vegas to me is, it's just not my cup of tea, basically. I don't gamble. I don't do that stuff, you know. But it's nice to go, and I love to hang out with the guys because they're such good characters.
Is there an album in the future? Do you
Who
think?
Knows? Who yeah. knows? It's impossible. I mean, Mick's going through an illness now called Parkinson's, you know, which is not fun. He's been having it for 2 years. That's why you don't see him up on stage like you used to,
right.
Because his hands are shaking. You know, it's that shaking thing. But he can still play keyboard. So we're trying to work out, Mark Ronson wants to help produce, if we do the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame show in Cleveland in the fall, which I'm very much hoping we get inducted in April. Yeah. If we do that, I think Mick will be out behind a keyboard rather than play guitar, because Bruce can handle all that side. Whether Lou makes it or not, I don't know. I think he will, but I hope so.
Now, Mick still has that kind of head for creativity.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So that's what I'm saying. That's why I ask if there's an album in the future. I think it'd be phenomenal if you guys did another album.
Well, it's not out of the question, put it that way. I know that the guys, like me and Al especially, we love doing what we do. The energy's there because with the guys we've got in the band now, we know we can cover just all the bases. That's what we've got. So there is a future. It's not all coming to an end. It's just we just want to just slow it down a bit. Because I mean, yeah. Kevin, you've got to remember, he's been there 20 years now. That's a lot of work.
Yep.
And when they're not kids anymore, I mean, they're 50s, late 50s, 60s, you know, 60s, you know, they're getting on. The energy they put out on that stage is awesome. When I go up and play with them, I go, what the hell are you guys on?
Oh, yeah.
The same thing you guys were on when, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah, right.
Well, yeah, well, that was then. The
energy.
That's right.
80 is the new 60. You know that.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Well, I'm not far off of that now.
But look at people. The people at Jagger and McCartney, I mean, it's kind of defying.
It's inspiring is what it is.
I mean, yeah. It is. Paul's still doing three-hour shows.
I know.
Oh, yeah. God. And he's in his 80s. I mean, it's awesome.
It's crazy.
I love him. I love him. Yeah.
Oh, me too. Absolutely love him.
So this is a picture from a few years ago. This is my youngest son, Benjamin, and he's my three boys, and he's there by Mick. So when he was a really little kid, he really didn't listen to music, but the one band that he listened to, and my other boys, they like Foreigner, but they've heard it so damn much over the years. The other night at dinner, Luke was like, you know, I like Foreigner now, but I got to tell you, Ben, you killed him for me for about 5 years, because his room was, it was hot. And I'm not even exaggerating just because we're talking to you. It was out of control, just all the time, Foreigner, Foreigner, Foreigner. He had every album on CD. And so when they came around, I went over to Dayton. I took him. I got a hold of Mary. I said, I've got a favor for you. I don't usually ask this for my family or anybody, but my youngest son, I got to get him back to meet the band. She's like, absolutely. And so we got there and he went in, and they were so good to him, but he was just like over them. But as he's shaking their hands, he's like introducing himself and naming their names.
You know, awesome.
I knew who Mick was and Kelly, but I did not know everybody's name. He did.
they're really good at those guys.
I mean, yeah.
You know, because of COVID, when that hit, we had to curtail a lot of the meet and greet stuff and things like that. So now what they do, they sit on the stage and have the audience, people who want to do meet and greet, sit in the audience and ask some questions. They sit on chairs and answer them, you know, because they can't have contact. We have to be careful because of the COVID thing.
Of course.
Yeah, you know, that's to understand. So we don't have people backstage anymore. Like, we always used to be nuts, you know, everybody everywhere. No, that doesn't happen. We have our own rooms. And we just have to be careful because these things spread so easily.
There's too much at stake. In a weird way, like, I think some people will be like, man, that's not very personal. Why? But it's like, this is their job. And they're out on the road for 30, 40, 50 dates. And if these people pay a lot of money to go see him, and in order to keep them healthy, they have to be there and be healthy enough to play. So, I think it's one misstep,
you screw the entire.
Well, you know, missing shows is not in our, you know, it's just not what we want to be doing. You know?
Right.
Nope.
A, it's too expensive to keep, you know, road crew and everybody going and all this stuff.
Then you have to make them up. We had to do that last year on the show. So,
oh, I know. But anyway, I mean, looking forward, I think this whole thing with the inclusion into the list of people to go into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has given us a real lift. It's really energized everybody.
Yeah.
We've realized suddenly someone got the recognition that it's been deserved for so long.
You guys definitely deserve it.
100%. It almost makes no sense that you haven't been anteed up well before now.
Yeah. I know. But there you go. We are now, and we want to bet everybody to vote for us as much as they can. All you've got to do is go vote.rockhall.com, and you can vote for Foreigner.
Yep.
So you got to do.
Easy peasy. You got free here.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Hey, I got one question. So I was a big fan.
I just got one question.
So we kind of skimmed over it, but I was a big Steve Marriott fan, and I bought those records when they first came out. They weren't huge sellers in America, at least the Playmates record and the 78 and the Shade records. But there's a few really great tracks on there.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like Too Many Crossroads, that ballad is a beautiful one. Find It. Did you play? I mean, you remember the disco? Find It.
Yeah.
Do you have any? I love those tunes. But anyway, do you have any stories about Steve Marriott which you could share with us with it, and none of us would get in trouble?
I mean, it's kind of difficult, believe you me, because I mean, Steve was a one-off. There was no doubt about it. I mean, his voice, the power of his voice. For a small guy, he was only about 5'5", you know, 5'6", maybe.
Yeah.
And I've seen him at Madison Square Garden actually come off the mic and sing to 18,000 people, and you can hear him.
I saw him do the same thing in Humble Pie's 1980 version. Yeah. So I'm doing the same thing.
It's just awesome power. I mean, there's so many memories of Steve that I think about, because literally I was in bed one morning. It's like 4 o'clock in the morning, and the phone rang. I thought, who the hell be calling me? Who do you think it was? Steve Marriott, right? I asked, I said, Steve. He said, Rick, what are you doing? I said, I'm asleep, man. What do you think I'm doing? He said, well, we're in the studio down at Joe Brown's place, and I've just had a real argument with Ronnie Lane, and we want a bass player. We want you. I said, you're kidding, man. You've got to be kidding. I said, I'm not a small face. I'm a foot taller than you guys.
That's right. All those guys were little, yeah.
This is the truth. I mean, you know, my wife, she'll tell you the same. It was like nuts. So I said, well, what do you want me to do? He said, come tomorrow. He said, when we start up about 5 o'clock. So I went over to Joe Brown's house, and I know Joe. I've worked with him a bit. And he said, come on, let's just go in the studio and play. And they said, you're in the band now. That's it. You're a small face. I had to call David Gilmore. I said, David, you're not going to believe this. He said, what? I said, I've just become the small face.
You're going around tapping him on the head because you're sort of like an NBA
you
player.
Little fellas.
It's crazy.
You little guys doing today.
Attaboy. Attaboy.
Ian McLagan, Steve Marriott, Kenny Jones. I mean, they got great sense of humor. I mean, we had so much fun.
Ian McLagan was a really sweet guy.
He was a nice man.
Yeah.
You know, what was really weird is when the small faces kind of came to an end, Kenny Jones joined The Who.
Yeah.
Mac was with the Stones on tour. Mm-hmm. And I went off and joined Foreigner.
Wow.
And Steve was doing pubs in England. Can you believe that?
That's really a shame.
It's just not right, is it?
No.
But that's
really a shame.
That's how Steve ended up. And sorry, you know, he tragically died in a house fire when he was drunk. That's so sad.
Yeah,
All the people. Because when I first met Steve, he was very together. He used to start smoking a few joints and stuff, but he didn't really do anything else. And he looked great. He had the hair, he had the look.
Yep.
He had a beautiful wife, Jenny, and he had a beautiful little place called Beehive Cottage in the country in Essex. And he had his own studio.
The studio.
He had life made, man. He had it sussed, as they say in England, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's just a tragic that we lost him when we did.
Yeah,
certainly is.
I remember him well. We went to his funeral, and Peter was there too, and Peter Frampton. And we just said, this is a sad, very sad day to see that small coffin up there, sitting, watching, doing the service. We had his wife, Jenny Marriott, with us because she wanted support. And my wife and her are very good friends. And it was just such a sad day to remember. It really was.
Let's think about
happier times.
Yeah,
that's right.
For sure.
Think about Rock and Roll Hall of Fame speeches that you're going to have to do.
That's right. Get that speech together.
Well, I'm already thinking about it.
Yeah,
I bet.
Of course. Yeah. You should be. You should be.
Well, you're certainly capable of that.
Yeah.
I hope so. I mean, I'm so happy. I mean, I'm 76 now. I'm still reasonably together. I can still get it together and play and talk.
Yeah, you are. You are.
My memory's good.
Well, no shit. I mean,
no kidding, man.
He just went through about 300 names in this interview alone.
You remember the month that you were here doing this.
Yeah.
I mean, 50, 60 years ago. Okay.
Well, to me, memories are everything, you know, the things that you do in your life. And but my biggest memories, I've said this many times, I was in the right place at the right time for all the things that happened to me in my life. Mm. And it's just been a memory that I've got stuck in my head. Why was I there? Why did it happen? I don't know. But
I think that's the essence of an awful lot of people's success is, apart from talent and apart from a good work ethic, just having the luck of good timing.
It's true. Yeah. It sure does help. It really does. But it's been really nice talking to you guys. You guys are really right on it. You really know your stuff. Because I get to talk to a lot of people, as you can imagine, doing interviews. Yeah. Some people don't know what you guys know. I can tell you that.
That's true.
And I have to tell them. Yep. I said, no, you got that wrong, bro. And it wasn't like that, you know. Because they seem to think I just walked into bar. And I said, no, it wasn't like that.
Right. Clearly. Yeah. Thank you for sharing with us. We really appreciate it. Yeah.
Well, thank you, guys. It's been nice talking to you.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.